Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the mounting troubles for Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who has not only lost his security clearance, but is using the White House for his private boardroom meetings with bankers who have loaned him over $500 million for his troubled real estate investments. William Cohan, a former senior Wall Street investment banker who is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times, joins us to discuss Kushner's apparent lack of political judgment in recommending the firing of Comey and his disastrous business record, which leaves one to ponder why he was given such an array of amazingly important responsibilities by Trump. We'll also assess how much Wall Street is rattled by Trump's impetuous imposition of tariffs on steel and aluminum against the advice of every senior official except Wilbur Ross, who made a fortune out of investing in distressed U.S. steel companies. Then we'll speak with David Patrikarakos, a contributing editor at The Daily Beast and a contributing writer at Politico, whose latest book just out is War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. We'll discuss how narrative war is now far more important than physical war because of new technologies in social media that shape public perceptions in what David calls a virtual mass enlistment, regardless of what happens on the battlefield. We will examine how much Russia has perfected this new form of information and hybrid warfare, and whether Americans will ever be able to rally around a clear and present danger or a challenge we all agree is real. Then finally, in showcasing Russia's latest strategic weapons in his annual State of the Nation address today, Vladimir Putin bragged about Russia's new hypersonic nuclear cruise missile and nuclear torpedo depicted on a giant video screen behind him in a simulated nuclear attack on Florida, claiming his new weapons are invincible. Theodore Postol, a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he researches ballistic missile defense technologies and fraud in the U.S. missile defense program, joins us to discuss what will likely be described by our defense hawks as the hypersonic gap and how our emphasis on missile defense has led to Putin taking the steps he announced today. And joining us now is William Cohan, who's a former Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard, Frere & Company. He is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times, and his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Bill, what do you make of Jared Kushner's troubles, or what is the word on the street about him? Because I understand that he's desperately underwater on 666 Fifth Avenue. He's got a $1.2 billion balloon payment due in February, and that might explain why he's been mixing business with his so-called diplomatic duties since he's got so many portfolios in the White House.
Well, Ian, this is exactly why, generally speaking, more wise White House advisors and White House employees divest themselves of any potential investments that could result in conflicts of interest. Jared Kushner, like his father-in-law, has put himself in a position where he can be manipulated and influenced. And so, you know, that is a real detriment to our democracy and a real detriment to what we stand for. And I think that not only 666 Fifth Avenue, but, you know, he got these loans from Apollo, which is a very big and powerful private equity firm, after, which is not something they usually do, by the way. They don't usually make loans to other real estate entities, sort of single-person, family-driven real estate entities. They're more of a buyout firm. But, you know, he gave access to some of the partners at Apollo to the White House, and they repaid the favor by, you know, making him several hundred million dollars worth of loans on real estate assets that needed to be refinanced. I think that's a harbinger of what's going to come. He's lucky with 666 Fifth Avenue, which, of course, he's spent billions on overpaying and basically has lost control of it already to to Vornado Realty, his partner. But, you know, this is exactly the reason, Ian, why this kind of thing is frowned upon. And it's so obvious and so, you know, grotesque when you see it in the light of day. And to think that he's doing it and thinking that the American people won't figure it out or notice it is really even more discouraging.
Well, he got over $500 million from these two loans, one with Citibank and one with Apollo, as you mentioned, after meeting with the heads in the White House, one of whom apparently was promised a job. And that's pretty hard to avoid a kind of quid pro quo there, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like he's turning the Oval Office or the White House into his personal boardroom.
Or you know, I mean, we've unfortunately from time to time seen presidents and their staffs, you know, put for sale signs on aspects of the White House, predominantly, you know, access to the White House. I mean, I'm sure what he would say or what the people at Apollo would say is, you know, totally separate. You know, Josh Harris may have been under consideration for a position in the White House, which didn't happen, completely separately from that. You know, Apollo is in the business of making loans to corporations and businesses all over the world. It's in the business of making investments in those things. And this was evaluated separately and treated separately. And there's no link between the two. That's, of course, what they'll say. But when you actually sort of peel it back and look at it sort of in the cold light of day, it's clear that there is influence peddling, influence buying. It stinks. It's rotten. You know, again, unfortunately, it seems to me it's very typical of what this White House is willing to do, and whether it's cabinet secretaries flying around on private jets or spending $30,000 on desks. I mean, it's really, really gotten out of control. And, you know, Jared is really kind of one of the worst offenders, because as we recall from like 6 months ago or 9 months ago, his sister or his cousin or whatever was trying to use HB1 visas to get investments from people in China to help bail them out of 666 Fifth Avenue or other investments that they have in New Jersey. And again, that is just, I mean, they cut that off quickly, but that's, you know, typical of apparently the approach that they're taking here, which is completely unethical, possibly illegal, and you know, this should stop. But it may not, because it's Donald Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with William Cohan, as a former Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author, whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoon, The Secret History of Lazard Frere & Company. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times, and his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. Well, the picture that's emerging, though, Bill Cohan, is a sense that their incompetence is only exceeded by their arrogance. And we know, and first, in terms of politics, the incompetence is rampant, apparently, because Jared Kushner was apparently the main person who advised Donald Trump to fire Jim Comey. And look what that achieved. And as far as I can tell, 666 Fifth Avenue, he bought that. First of all, he spent $10 million buying the New York Observer, and he was dating Ivanka. And in order to impress her and his future father-in-law, he bought 666 Fifth Avenue, putting very little down. Apparently, it's a real architectural mess and not a particularly good building to begin with.
Yes.
And he's...
nice location.
Right. So... can you make the case that the man that's been put in charge of so many portfolios is not just politically incompetent, but not a particularly good businessman?
Oh, no. I think there's absolutely no question that he is, like his father-in-law, frankly, not a particularly good businessman. I mean, Donald was not a very good real estate investor. He made a few good investments. You'd have to say that Trump Tower, 40 Wall Street were probably good investments, but many of them, especially his casino businesses in Atlantic City, were absolute disasters. We had somewhere between 4 and 6 bankruptcies. There's no question that, you know, the Kushner family was trying to make it big in Manhattan, just like the Trumps were trying to make it big in Manhattan after being in Queens. And he stepped up to the plate, and he paid $1.7 billion for 666 Fifth Avenue, which, as you said, is a kind of a failed real estate enterprise, especially when you pay that kind of price for it. I mean, the price was literally over the top. He's since lost it. His most of his equity position to Steve Roth at Vornado, who was smart enough to sort of pick his pocket. But he still has this balloon mortgage payment due. It's a huge albatross. It could be the end of, you know, whatever fortune the Kushners have left after his father, you know, went to jail, and after, you know, losing his investment probably in The Observer and other things. So, I think the whole thing stinks. He's not a very good businessman. Of course, either was Donald. They're hucksters. They're they're good at that. And he's given this huge portfolio. And, you know, frankly, it's just another a stain on the reputation of our country and the leadership of our country. And it's really, really unfortunate. The guy needs to leave Washington. He needs to get out of Washington. Jared has to be done in Washington. And Ivanka, they just have to come back to New York or wherever they're going to go, New Jersey, and put their tail between their legs. And, you know, we'll close the book on that chapter. And hopefully soon we'll close the book on the Donald Trump chapter.
But if there is the kind of mixing of government duties and private business, which there appears to be, and apparently Rod Rosenstein was the one person who told General Kelly that there was no way that they were going to give Kushner a permanent security clearance, and that's why it was pulled. So the fact that Rod Rosenstein, who's in charge of Mueller, and Mueller's apparently looking into some of the activities of Jared Kushner in meeting with the Russian ambassador and talking about having a special private channel, and meeting with the VNB Bank, which is basically a KGB or a FSB bank. And I've been told that he shook down the Qatari leaders for a lot of money and basically said, you know, if you don't give me money, I'll sick the young boy king in Saudi Arabia on you. And he's poised to do a blockade on you. And if, you know, I'll hold him off if you give me the money. And they told him to get lost. So if those reports are true, this has never happened before. As far as I can tell, mixing geopolitics with personal gain.
Yeah, it would be a new chapter. Clearly, I mean, we've had financial scandals in the past involving our government leaders. I mean, Teapot Dome scandal comes to mind, economic scandal involving White House officials. Look, I mean, hopefully you're right. Hopefully, you know, he didn't do these things because it's disgraceful. But if he did, then I have every confidence that Robert Mueller will be investigating this, digging this out, getting the facts, and perhaps indicting Jared Kushner. I mean, there are plenty of reports of him being very worried about being indicted. And so, you know, if he did these things, influence peddling, buying access, personal loans that benefit his family and his family trust, in exchange for influence and access to the White House. I mean, this is so out of bounds and so obviously corrupt that hopefully Robert Mueller will get to the bottom of it, and that'll be the end of it. But it goes, you know, Ian, as you know, to something deeper, which is that Donald Trump, refused to divest himself of his own businesses. Again, he's not required to, but if you are an ethical and moral person, of course, that's something you want to do. You don't want to have any way to be influenced. I mean, it seems like everyone in his administration has proven themselves to be someone who could be influenced. And, you know, frankly, enough is enough. And, you know, the time has come to stop all of this. And I guess we just are going to have to wait for Robert Mueller to do his thing before we can, you know, begin to get, you know. But a lot of these people, as we know, are just sort of dropping like flies out of the administration. But, you know, now it's in fact the Kushner was, you know, selling influence and access, then he's going to have to go too.
Well, just the last couple of minutes, turning to Wall Street, which you're very familiar with, William Cohen, it's taking a dive. It took a dive recently, but it's taking a dive, obviously, in response to Donald Trump slapping tariffs on steel and aluminum. And I don't know whether there's a concern about a trade war looming, but it sort of doesn't make any sense what he's doing. And apparently some of his advisors, like Gary Cohn, Mattis, and others, didn't think it was a good idea. So I guess what we're reminded of here with these continuing sort of strange antics of Donald Trump and his impetuous behavior and the things that he's done and the things he's got away with, like not even releasing his tax returns, is it should remind us all the enormous power of the presidency and how elections have consequences.
Well, I was just going to say that, Ian. I mean, as people say, the cliche, elections matter. This was an election that Donald Trump won, apparently, fair and square. He won the Electoral College. That's the way the system is designed. He did what he had to do to get the votes in those states to win. So this has real consequences. I mean, whether it's rolling back regulations on Wall Street, whether it's rolling back regulations across other industries, whether it's this ridiculous tax law that I think I cannot fathom for the life of me why we've increased the deficit, the debt on this country of $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years to give corporate executives and shareholders who already have plenty of money already an additional pile of money. Some of that benefit, if it needed to happen at all, should have gone to the more to the American people and not to shareholders and corporate treasuries. And it just makes absolutely no sense. The priorities are completely off and misguided, in my opinion. Not what was needed at the, you know, in the 10th year of an expansion. I think the stock market got way ahead of itself. I think this correction is frankly healthy and a good buying opportunity, as Warren Buffett would say. So that's, I think, the good news for investors. I mean, it's but, you know, I think that the administration's economic policies just make no sense whatsoever. And, you know, starting a trade war on steel and aluminum makes no sense. You know, all this protectionist behavior and talk that these and alienating all our allies and, you know, befriending our enemies. I just don't understand what this guy is up to, frankly, and we're just going to have to survive it. We've survived others, not quite as bad as this guy, but I remember, you know, a lot of people didn't like Ronald Reagan for a long time, and we survived that, and we survived George W. Bush. I mean, we're going to have to survive, but it's really going to be unpleasant along the way.
Well, just in closing, the idea that you've got these characters like Wilbur Ross and Pina Navarro driving this incredibly counterproductive move of a 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum, which is basically hitting the Japanese and the Canadians, as far as I can tell, both of whom are allies. What does it say then about the fact that you've got everybody else is lined up against him, the Gary Cohn, McMaster, Mattis, etc., Rex Tillerson? That tells me something, that the idea that we all think, oh, Wall Street's more powerful than Washington, Trump's running roughshod over everybody.
Well, I mean, he is, to the extent that he can do things without Congress's backing. He's obviously had a much tougher time getting things through Congress and laws passed. I mean, there has been a debate, a healthy debate or whatever, disagreements in the administration from the beginning between the so-called globalists and the so-called nationalists. And I thought we had sort of gotten rid of the nationalists with the end of the Steve Bannon era. You know, and Wilbur Ross, though, is a total creation of Wall Street. Let's not forget, he made a fortune buying rolling up steel companies. So now he's, you know, I guess one could say he's benefiting the industry that he made a fortune from by imposing tariffs on foreign steel. Maybe that's in his own. Who knows what he's ended up having to divest from his own portfolio? And he's not the most reputable character either. He cheated his the limited partners out of fees. He charged too much and was fined by the SEC. He's you know, in lawsuits with his former partners about the way he managed his private equity firm. And, you know, don't forget, he rolled up the coal industry. He rolled up the steel industry. I mean, this is a guy who obviously is doing something with these tariffs to help industries that he once made a fortune from. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know why this is happening. You know, so-called Donald Trump makes these campaign promises that he's keeping. I think he's going to get quite the rude awakening at the November election. And then in November 2020, I think he's going to find that he's not as big a winner as he would like us to think he is.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian, for having me. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with William Cohen as a former Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author, whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoon, The Secret History of Lazard, Frere & Company. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times, and his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of a new book, War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century.
Revolving doors, what have I done? For someone on the TV, a tapping low. Revolving doors, what will I become? In the redneck sun, he paid up for a seven.
What y'all wanna do? Wanna be hackers, code crackers, slackers? Wasting time with all the chat room yakkers. 9 to 5 chilling at Hewlett Packard. Working at a desk with a dumb little placard. Yeah, paying the bills with my mad programming skills. Defragging my hard drive for thrills. I got me 100 gigabytes of RAM. I never feed trolls and I don't read spam. Install the T1 line in my house. Always at my PC, double clicking on my Miz House.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Patrikarakos, who is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, a contributing editor at The Daily Beast and a contributing writer at Politico. He has written for The New York Times, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. And his latest book just out is War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Patrikarakos.
Thank you for having me on.
And David, I mean, it seems to me that we've seen the Mueller indictments, and that's obviously got a lot of people concerned, and there was hearings with the head of the NSA and Cyber Command. But it seems that even though he basically said he hasn't been authorized to do anything by the president, I think there was some confusion over what the NSA and the Cyber Command actually can do. And it seems that retaliating against interference via social media with cyber war makes no sense, because the only time we've done that was against Iran with Stuxnet, and that had blowback as well. So let's sort of sort out that confusion between these operations like influence campaigns that go below the kinetic level and under the radar, as opposed to the idea that the American public or some members and certainly senators are clamoring for a response to make Russia pay for what it's done.
Well, I mean, they're two very distinct things. I mean, cyber warfare and information operations carried out, let's say, on social media platforms, which is what I discussed in my book. So I think we have to make a real distinction between the two. I mean, the Mueller indictments, or the Mueller case, the whole Trump collusion issue, has a lot to do with, you know, did Russia interfere with the elections? Obviously, we had the tech hearings that looked at fake news ads bought, all these sorts of things. But I mean, there is a very big difference. Things like Stuxnet, for example, which I covered actually extensively in my first book on Iran's nuclear program, are a form of cyber warfare. I would say that they're probably, you know, the future of kinetic warfare. Propaganda operations, which are becoming increasingly popular as narratives become increasingly popular in warfare, or important. I mean, narratives have always been important in warfare. Propaganda is always as old as warfare itself, but as warfare changes, whereas we once had military operations on the ground supporting propaganda operations supporting military operations on the ground, we're increasingly seeing military operations on the ground supporting propaganda operations on TV and in cyberspace online. So I think we have to make a clear distinction between the two.
Well, would you accept the thesis that many argue that the Russians have got to jump on us, that this hybrid warfare that they've been practicing, that we're behind the eight ball on that?
Look, I think in terms of disinformation tactics, hybrid warfare, whatever you want to call it, certainly the Russians are the masters at it. And, I mean, one thing that it is critical to note when it comes to this area is that the West, democracies like the US, like Britain, Australia, New Zealand, are democracies. And there are certain things that we cannot do. So we cannot set up troll farms in the way that the Russians can. Or, I mean, we could try, but they'd be exposed pretty rapidly by the press and shut down fairly rapidly, I would imagine. Russian troll farms have been repeatedly exposed, and yet they continue to carry on doing their work in Russia, you know, with essentially government funding, albeit via one or two proxies.
But if you read the Mueller indictment against the 13 Russians and three entities and the troll farm in St. Petersburg that's owned by the Putin chef, who also runs, yeah, you know, he's like Russia's version of Eric Prince of Blackwater. Yeah. My only sense is that America's defense has to be in improving its civic education and public engagement, because we don't have critical thinking anymore in this country. I mean, we're incredibly stupid, incredibly gullible. We believe the most stupid conspiracy theories, and we have a president who believes in conspiracy theories. So when you look at what the Russians did to us and whether it was effective or not is a big question. My conclusion is, well, you know, it only works because we're stupid.
Well, I mean, it can be quite effective even on not stupid people. I would say, however, that you are right that the growth of conspiracy theory in the West is a real concern. A lot of this has been turbocharged by social media. And in terms of literacy and civic engagement, you're absolutely right. We need to teach people social media literacy. We need to basically enable them to detect or give them the critical tools with which to identify what is propaganda, what is conspiracy theory, and what is in fact the truth, because the point of Russian disinformation is actually very sort of different to the propaganda of old. I mean, if you look at Soviet Union's propaganda, it was always geared towards projecting the Soviet Union as the ideal society, the utopian state. This was its point, essentially. Russian propaganda, modern Russian propaganda, doesn't concern itself with that. It's not interested in projecting a positive image of Russia. I'm sure it would like to do, ideally, but I get it. You know, I think it senses that that's not possible. Its goal is to confuse and distort and muddy the waters with so many competing narratives that people are so befuddled that they cannot recognize the truth when they see it. And in this sense, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump are alike. Now, I don't want to, you know, make too much of a comparison, because one is a dictator in all but name, and the other, despite his manifest shortcomings, still leads the world's most powerful and largest, most powerful democracy. But in both instances, one thing is the same, which is not to twist the truth or lie like the politicians of old, but to subvert the very idea that objective truth exists at all. So you go from Bill Clinton, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, to a straight-out lie, to Donald Trump or his spokespeople, who will say that his inauguration crowns were bigger than Obama's. And when you can see that they weren't, and when they're called out on it, what do they say? Kellyanne Conway just comes on and says, well, we're all offering alternative facts, and this is hugely dangerous. You're absolutely right.
And again, I'm speaking with David Patrikarakos, who is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, a contributing editor at The Daily Beast and a contributing writer at Politico. He's written for The New York Times, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. And his latest book just out is War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. Well, it seems, though, that this sort of started with Putin's political technologists, as they're called, Surkov, and there was a very good book written about it.
Yes, nothing by my good friend Peter Pomerantsev, yes.
Right, nothing is true and everything is possible. But the difference here in the United States would seem that it's true. We don't have a consensus about what is true and what is real anymore. We used to when Uncle Walter Cronkite delivered the news on CBS, but those days are over. How do you stop this trend towards reality shopping, where Christians get their news from Christian television and broadcasting, liberals from MSNBC and conservatives from Fox?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. There's an increased balkanization of our, as people like to say it, information ecosystem. And, you know, I mean, what you've mentioned there are TV stations, which, you know, always had a slant. I mean, more worrying is that the number one news source now for young Americans is social media. And there you You construct essentially your own information reality by who you follow and who you friend. So if you take a conflict or a hot political issue, you know, 20 years ago you'd have watched CNN or the BBC or, you know, even Fox News or Islam, but you still probably would have seen the same images, the same, you know, government interviews. Obviously, a spin would be put on it, but everyone would be, you know, watching the same thing. Now, if you look at a conflict, which I look at sort of in my book, War in 140 Characters, you're looking at different reality. You're looking at different footage. You're looking at different analysis. And what this means is the compromise with your opponents, with your people you disagree with, it becomes harder because you're not existing in the same reality. Therefore, someone who disagrees is not merely wrong. They're a liar. You know, they're coming from bad faith. They're a propagandist. And this is very, very dangerous because, I mean, it subverts the idea of civil discourse, of argumentation, of disputation, and essentially organizes people into differing parts where all they do is hurl abuse at each other. And as I say, social media has turbocharged this.
Well, there's no question, though, that in this last election, the Republicans and the Trump campaign got a jump on social media. Obviously, you know, with 2/3 of Americans getting information via Facebook, they went after Facebook with this canard that there was a liberal bias in their curation of the news. And Zuckerberg panicked and turned to algorithms, which were quickly gamed. And the most amazing thing that I've learned is that this has been documented in Wired magazine, is that Zuckerberg was heavily influenced by, of all people, Rupert Murdoch. So
yeah. It's
a pretty amazing, isn't it, how Hillary Clinton was in the old world of TV advertising where the Trump people recognized this new arena of information manipulation, social media.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, they got the jump. They got the jump on her hugely. It was a terrible mistake by Clinton. Now, whether... they also got external help. It seems that they did. Zuckerberg has admitted at the tech hearings that you know, there was a lot of advertising bought from Russian sources, and this is why Facebook has reluctantly agreed to make some concessions. But I think the tech hearings are very instructive because, first of all, the social media companies were essentially dragged before it. Secondly, they made concessions that do not go far enough, begrudgingly. And thirdly, since then, in the months since then, I don't think much has changed. And this is the point. I don't think much will change. I think self-policing doesn't work. And unfortunately, I think the situation is going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
So is there a kind of perversion of democracy in this, in as much as there's this notion that this is spreading individual rights to not just be consumers of information, but to be producers of information? The best analogy I could come up with was in the 1960s when people took LSD and they, you know, put a bit of some paint gel on a piece of glass and flashed it on the ceiling, and suddenly they were Picassos. So is there a kind of perversion of... You know, we hear from the plutocrats in this country all the time, like the Coppolas, they keep talking about freedom, freedom, freedom. All these Supreme Court rulings are all about freedom. And it feels to me, to some extent, that social media is being sold as an instrument of freedom, when you can argue that it's enslaving people because people like, you know, Russian troll farms can manipulate them.
Oh, absolutely. The term cyber utopianism, coined by... the author Evgeny Morozov, was this early belief that give a man or woman access to the internet, it will set them free. And for a time, it seemed like that. You saw, you know, revolutions in Egypt and the Arab Spring that were largely driven, or certainly helped in terms of mobilizing people onto the streets by social media. But in the end, the tools that benefit the oppressed will come to benefit the oppressor as long as they harness them properly. And you're absolutely right. I mean, look, we're enslaved by social media on a personal level. It's addictive. It's like junk food. Yeah, it makes us miserable. I mean, this much is clear. No one ever spent a sustained amount of time on Twitter and came off feeling better, in my experience. And at the same time, yes, it's become a tool for autocratic regimes and a very powerful tool if you know how to use it properly. And the Russians know how to use it very well indeed. I would agree 100% with what you say. As I say, the story of social media is very much the story, in my opinion, of the rise and fall of hope.
So just to sort of expand on the thesis in your new book, David, War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century, the idea that narrative war has become far more important than physical war due to these new technologies that we've been talking about that shape public perceptions of conflict in real time, regardless of what is actually happening on the battlefield. Let's, you know, do a hypothetical. Had these social media tools existed in 1914, and say the Kaiser was like Putin, he had the jump on social media, could you have avoided the Holocaust in terms of the thousands of young men that just marched across no man's land to certain death on both sides? Could you have a situation where the British basically believed that the Kaiser was a great guy?
I mean, I'm not so sure because they would have, I mean, look, counterfactuals are always counterfactuals. First, I'd say, look, I'm not saying in all instances that the narrative war is more important than the physical war. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that increasingly in certain conflicts, the narrative war has, like Ukraine, Russia, for example, that is all essentially about a narrative war designed to destabilize Ukraine. Putin is not seeking a military victory over Ukraine, which he easily could achieve. Although holding the country would be harder, and it was a lot, you know, it would be a lot more difficult now. He could have easily done it in the beginning. I mean, to take the 1914 analogy, I mean, what you don't see is, you know, with Russian misinformation, for example, Russian propaganda, you don't see, you know, a load of Americans thinking Russia's great. I mean, you have that constituency who likes strongmen, who like him anyway, but I don't think these are people who are on Twitter, for example. A lot of the Trump base aren't on Twitter. I mean, it's essentially the journalists and people like that who live there, which is why Trump's tweets get magnified into the mainstream media. I don't think it's not about convincing people you're a great guy. It's about muddying the waters so much that you don't know what's true or what is not. So I'm not sure it would have avoided the Holocaust of World War One, although it certainly would have made it a very different game. It might have made it less bloody as people sought to, you know, gain hearts and minds over actual physical corpses. But again, counterfactuals, one never really knows.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Patrick.
Thank you for having me on.
Yes, and let's do a follow-up, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Many thanks, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Patrick Harakos, who is the author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, a contributing editor at The Daily Beast and a contributing writer at Politico. He has written for The New York Times, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. And his latest book just out is War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about Vladimir Putin's bragging today about Russia's new hypersonic nuclear cruise missile and nuclear torpedo and whether our defense hawks will now start talking about the hypersonic gap. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Theodore Postel, who's a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Previously, he worked as the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and as a science and policy advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. He's won awards for uncovering and publicizing false claims about missile defenses and currently researches ballistic missile defense technologies, fraud in the U.S. missile defense programs, and works to reduce nuclear dangers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Theodore Pastol.
Nice to be here.
And today, of course, in his annual State of the Nation address in Russia, Vladimir Putin bragged about Russia's new hypersonic nuclear cruise missile and nuclear torpedo, which were depicted on a giant video screen in a simulated attack on Florida. And he claimed that these new weapons are invincible. But the point is that this seems to be, I know when we last spoke, you were, well, we've spoken over the years, but you've been concerned about the dangers of nuclear war in South Asia and the deteriorating Russian nuclear infrastructure. But what has happened is that Russia's invested in its nuclear infrastructure and new weapons systems because we have moved towards missile defense. And I take it you believe that what Putin showcased today is a direct consequence of our emphasis on missile defense.
Well, I think it's certainly the case. I think the United States has been modernizing its strike forces, particularly the ballistic missile forces, so as to have even higher kill capabilities against very hard military installations in Russia, also in China as well. And this dramatic increase in the kill capability of U.S. forces, actually by a factor of almost three in terms of the ability to destroy numbers of targets, is certainly causing concern in Russian military and political circles. It creates the appearance, whether or not the United States actually intends to do this, it creates the appearance that we think we can fight and win a nuclear war, or we at least want to have the option to fight and win a nuclear war against Russia. In combination with missile defenses, that also creates the appearance that we are trying to not only have a strike capability, but a capability to reduce the consequences of a Russian retaliation. Now, these weapons that Putin is emphasizing right now are weapons that not even in theory could be dealt with by ballistic missile defenses. These are weapons that fly, in one case, flies very low and fast and could not be engaged by ballistic missile defenses, which try to shoot down targets at high altitude. And, of course, the underwater torpedo or super torpedo, whatever one wants to call it, could only be intercepted in principle with some kind of anti-submarine weapon, but this would not be, in practical terms, it would not be possible because of the speed of this weapon would be so high that it would be impractical to use torpedoes or depth bombs against it. So what he's basically saying in terms of pointing at these weapon systems is that the United States should never hope to be able to gain an advantage on Russia by attacking it first and then using its missile defenses. This is, of course, in the context of this nuclear policy review that the Pentagon just issued, where it emphasizes the principle that the United States could strike first with many nuclear weapons if it chose to. So one has to understand that the Russians might actually believe what we're saying. And if they do, they should be scared. And my assessment is that they're pretty worried about what's going on in the American nuclear arsenal right now.
But we've seen this bad movie before. In November of 1983, there was a nuclear war scare over the Able Archer NATO exercise, which was inherently a first use of nuclear weapons because the belief was that the Warsaw Pact had a preponderance of conventional weaponry. and the aging gerontocracy in the Kremlin believed it literally when Ronald Reagan referred to Russia as the evil empire, that they'd end up on the ash heap of history, and when Cap Weinberger talked about nuclear decapitation, they took that very personally, and they were scared to death. And we almost had a nuclear war out of the perceptions on the Russian side that we were out to get them. So here we are again. This is crazy.
Well, I think the only way to reduce the chances of these kinds of mistakes is to recognize, to recognize a simple fact, that it is not possible, it is in no way possible to fight and win a nuclear war between these two large states. It's the amount of damage the nuclear weapons would do would be so great that it would affect the other state and their friends and allies at levels beyond anything we have ever contemplated in terms of human catastrophes. And that's not a... That statement I made is not based on some kind of opinion about policy. It's based on a factual evaluation of the physical effects of nuclear weapons. So anyone who wants to debate this better get their physics book out and explain how you're not going to have these secondary consequences of nuclear weapons. So you can wave your hands all you want and say somebody is unrealistic. You know, if you have more imagination, you can imagine fighting and winning. But that is a total fantasy with regard to the physical realities associated with the use of these weapons. And right now, you have a lot of people running around, as we did during the Cold War, saying, oh, if you're a big thinker, I sometimes think of them as no thinkers. If you're a big thinker, you would understand that if you're willing to think out of the box, you would understand that these possibilities are real. Well, these possibilities are not real. They're based on a misunderstanding of the effects of nuclear weapons, which is a physical phenomenon. So my belief is that the only sensible way for both of these great nuclear powers to deal with each other is to basically acknowledge, not only verbally, but in terms of how one modernizes their nuclear weapon systems, is to acknowledge that you can only use these weapons in the hope you can deter something from happening that would lead to nuclear weapons being used. But to use these weapons in any way that resembles warfighting as if it were conventional, like, you know, using traditional weapons that are not nuclear, is just a fantasy. So, and the Russians have from time to time made that position clear. That was not their view in the very early days of the nuclear arms race. They actually had managed to construct a false system of beliefs that they could fight and win at some level in a nuclear war. And they understood later that turned out, you know, after a long series of talks, assessments, being advised by their own physics establishment, people like Andrei Sakharov, for instance, who one of their great heroes in physics, that this was just absolute craziness and that the net result would be the destruction of the then Soviet Union, and now, of course, it would be Russia. So we need to get back to these basic physical recognitions and acknowledgments of physical reality.
Well, what you're referring to there, Theodore Postol, is that the U.S., along with Sakharov, worked together to convince the Russian military leaders and the Kremlin that there was no point in nuclear defense. That's why we came up with the anti-ballistic missile treaty, because the recognition was that you can always saturate nuclear defense with more offense, and that if you go to the ABM defense route, all you'll do is stimulate the offense. So
is what we've been doing with Russia now.
Right, but it became the fundamentals of arms control, that that actually by disarming yourself in the sense that you don't have any protection, you were therefore limiting the number of nuclear weapons. And the minute you go into the into this fantasy land of Star Wars and nuclear defense, all you do is stimulate the offense. And now we found that Putin's found another way around it by having these systems that aren't ballistic, that are cruise missiles, low-flying, or torpedoes. So the lesson has not been learned.
Well, I think it's important. It's important to step back and realize that this is a consequence of current U.S. policies. I don't like, you know, fighting for, you know, against the Russians or for them, but I think it's important to depoliticize this debate and think of it in terms of the logic that each side must confront when they look at the behavior of the other side. If the other side looks like it thinks it can build defenses, which is the way we're behaving, that can cause it to escape the existential consequences of a nuclear attack, then the Russians at some level do not have much choice but to show in a demonstrable way that this is a fantasy. And this is one way Putin and his colleagues are trying to show that. This is not a statement that he's a good guy or a bad guy or anything. He's just doing what makes logical sense if he takes U.S. activities seriously. And I don't see how he can avoid taking them seriously. We take everything, and we should, we take everything that the Russians do seriously, and I don't see why they shouldn't take seriously what we do.
Well, there have been studies that indicate that if, for example, Pakistan and India have a nuclear war, and that's not exactly a very stable front there, and the Pakistanis, have the fastest-growing nuclear arsenal, the estimates are that a use of these nuclear weapons in South Asia could result in so much topsoil being thrown up into the atmosphere that would be radioactive that it could destroy global agriculture. So that's a...
In particular... It's not. You're basically right, but it's the detail is that there would be vast fires caused by these nuclear attacks on cities. These fires would create enormous amounts of smoke. That smoke would get carried to high altitudes and dissipated and distributed over the globe, and this would lead to a somewhat cooler general surface temperature, and that would be enough to cause mass starvation throughout the world. So it's just a small, in quotes, quote-unquote, nuclear war between India and Pakistan could do global damage on a tremendous scale through the secondary effects. You can imagine how bad it would be with a major confrontation of these states in the Northern Hemisphere. But it's true what you're saying. The details are not quite accurate, but, you know, I think you got it right. That a small war, small by some bizarre standard, it would not be small, of course, because of the millions of deaths, tens of millions of deaths that would happen in South Asia, but it would be small compared to what could happen between the United States and Russia. And, you know, and that alone would have a catastrophic impact on the global environment. You can't have a nuclear war and not have these global consequences. It's just a simple, plain, physical fact of nuclear weapons phenomenology. Anybody who claims to be a realist and claims otherwise is ignorant. They are really ignorant of the basic physical facts associated with nuclear weapons. They're not some kind of open-minded realist who's just being tough. They just are simply ignorant of the physical phenomenology.
Well, apparently, though, the very discussions that we're having are going on in the White House over North Korea, that basically Trump wants to do something. And the military leaders, Mattis, McMaster, and apparently are saying, no, it's not going to work. There's no such thing as a limited or a bloody nose attack. And apparently the president's quite frustrated by that. So this is, extraordinary that we're even, and of course the president has said, why do we have nuclear weapons if we don't use them? And which flies in the face of the very notion of deterrence. So that's what concerns me. Now, a lot of people are concerned about Trump's mental state and whether he's a suitable steward and should have access to the nuclear codes. But what we learn about him from what we're learning about the White House is not very comforting, particularly when it comes to North Korea.
No, I think it's very important that people in political leadership roles understand these basic fundamental facts associated with the use of nuclear weapons that we've been talking about. It may be one small ray of light in this, which I'm not arguing one should readily expect, is that our military leaders, whether we agree with them or not in many areas, I'm fortunate enough over many years to have known many, senior military officers. And whether or not I have agreed with them politically, and in many cases I haven't, I think they are all totally committed to defending the Constitution of the United States and the United States. And that is different from believing that you must follow the orders of a president if they are unlawful and if they would result in the destruction of the United States. So I'm not saying we should expect it, but I think we should not, if I were Trump, I would not be sanguine in the idea that if I ordered a nuclear attack, I wouldn't have mass resignations from my top military and that the Congress wouldn't intervene. I'm not suggesting that this is something we should hope for or that we should depend on, but I think it will not be as easy in all likelihood for Trump to order something like that unless we got somehow into a crisis mode where nobody... where everybody was poised to use the weapons, a full crisis, like the Cuban Missile Crisis or something like that. But other than those circumstances, which can happen, which is one of the reasons why we should be very careful, I am not sure at all that our military would follow an order to use these weapons. I don't sit around being comfortable with that thought, but I would certainly support them if they did that.
Well, Theodore Pastalla, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I hope it's been helpful talking.
It has been, and I thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Theodore Pastalla, who's a professor of science, technology, and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Previously, he worked at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment as a science and policy advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. He has won awards for uncovering and publicizing false claims about missile defenses and currently researches ballistic missile defense technology, fraud in the U.S. missile defense program, and works to reduce nuclear dangers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.